The Holy Gospel according to Matthew, the 25th chapter. Glory to you, O Lord. Jesus said to the disciples, "For it is as if a man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to their ability. Then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one who had the 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, 'Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have made 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master.' And the one with the 2 talents also came forward, saying, 'Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master.' Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, 'Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, have what is yours.' But his master replied, 'You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with the 10 talents. For all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.'" The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ. Please be seated. Grace, mercy, and peace be to you in the name of the resurrected Jesus. Amen. Just another happy story from Jesus. It's one of those where the conclusion of the gospel makes you want to say, "Really? Praise to you, O Christ, that's what we're responding to?" Certainly not. So let's set the scene again. We are in the midst of Matthew chapter 25, which bridges these last 3 weeks of our lectionary cycle, the conclusion of which is next week on Reign of Christ Sunday, the famous parable of the sheep and goats. Last week was the parable of the 10 bridesmaids, 5 who were wise and packed more oil along with them while they waited, anticipating a potential late arrival of the bridegroom, and 5 who were rather foolish and did not come prepared. Jesus' call at the end of that story was, "Be prepared, therefore, for you do not know the hour." And it's good advice. To be at work in God's kingdom here and now is indeed to be prepared. As we looked at last week, to take a look at what is in our immediate vicinity, to not get sucked into the vacuum of what can be a rather exhausting, anxiety-inducing global connectedness. There's far too much going on in the world that would leave us frozen and steal our energy. So perhaps being prepared with what's in our midst, our immediate resources, meeting immediate need, being prepared for what greets us in God's unfolding kingdom. On top of that, Jesus builds. On top of this preparedness, he tells what on the surface looks like a rather happy parable for those who can reproduce and even double the talents that's given, that they are entrusted with while the master goes away. Both Luke and Matthew tell this story, and in Luke it is clear that this individual is a rich landowner, which has a particular way of being in antiquity. This story forever has been entrusted to the first two slaves who double their talents. And I grew up hearing sermons and teachings about how we as people of the church ought to go out and use our talents wisely, which is really just not a good metaphor for what the actual talents in the story are about. It's a bad translation. And that somehow the third slave is thrown under the bus because they buried their talent and didn't use it wisely. They didn't invest it back into the world, and so there are no returns. Therefore, the master can label them wicked and lazy. And for at least the last two centuries in a capitalistic society, absolutely, the doubling of value is seen as one of well done. You are doing exactly what you are supposed to do. There is supposed to be infinite possibility and infinite growth, and so you ought to be able to double what you have been given. Anybody that works at the surface level of this system knows that that is patently false. So let's dig in and treat this parable on the level at which Jesus told it. In a world that knew that the third slave was absolutely correct in his judgment of the master, and that he says out loud what had been kept quiet and yet well known, that this is exactly the way the world works. Jesus is not dealing with a capitalistic society. This is a society built on benevolence. It's still a society where very few hold a majority of the resources, and the resources are extracted from those on the surface level who work the lands. And so interpreting this parable as a rich landowner who goes out and entrusts talents with his servants would be a proper way to approach it. Luke nails it on the head. Matthew leaves it a little more vague. But it's there when you think about the amount of resources that we are dealing with here. It's meant to be astronomical. To translate it into modern economic terms would be impossible. A talent is an absurd amount of money, and we'll just leave it at that. A talent in ancient equations is roughly about 6,000 denarii. So, depending on what you value a denarii at, 15 years worth of work. One talent. One servant given five, one servant given two, and one slave given one, with the expectation that they will grow in the master's absence. In this reality, this is not a land of infinite resources. Everything gained comes directly at the expense of another. And in the realm of Judea, in the time of Jesus, with the rich landowners in Jerusalem, their gain is exactly at the expense of those in the surrounding area. The farmers and landholders who are driven further into debt by taxes, who are then, because they cannot pay off taxes, in debt to those who take over the land. First, they become sharecroppers, and then the land gets taken from them entirely, and they are forced to work as day laborers, which, as we've experienced in other stories this fall, is not exactly a good position to be in, living day to day, almost below subsistence level. So for Jesus' audience, for his disciples who were on the ground level of production, being fishermen and agricultural folk, they know the other side of this story. They know that to make one denarii for a wealthier individual means taking that denarii out of the pockets of another. So to make one talent for a rich landowner means that there is a vacuum of one talent on the ground level for those who work tirelessly to produce those resources. This is a system of extraction at a ridiculous level. And it's even critiqued by philosophers at the time. Aristotle was very harsh of the idea of greed, which is what's demonstrated in a parable just like this. Anything above breaking even is seen as gluttony, is seen as harmful. And so for this kind of doubling of economic weight would be looked down upon by those of this time and place. But they knew that this is how the world worked. The master expected those talents to be doubled. And this tiered system of slavery meant that these folks had the business of cutting deals, of making sure that they could double their profits. And it's always, always, always at the expense of those on the ground level. This is not about growing money that's infinite. This is about a destructive practice that runs roughshod over the most vulnerable in its society. And readings of this in the last century have proven just that. Readings in an affluent society absolutely gravitate toward the doubling of talents as a good thing. But in agrarian societies, what some of us might label third world realities, they absolutely see it for the harsh system that it is, which makes them tend to gravitate toward the third slave. The third slave might actually be the hero of the story to those in antiquity and to those who are at the mercy of those who reap where they do not sow. The third slave tells it like it is. Master, I knew that you are a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you did not scatter. He doesn't pull his punches. That's exactly how this system works. He reaps where he does not sow because he has accumulated land that was originally not his. And I use his in particular because it would have been a man in this society, gluttonously gathering more and more. And he gathers where he does not scatter. At this point in the equation, the master is far removed from the daily operations of how this works. So I was afraid, and rightfully so. This slave knows how this system works because he's been a part of the mechanics of extraction. So I went and hid your talent in the ground here. Have what is yours, somewhat sarcastically. This third slave made a choice not to participate in a system of extraction that left people vulnerable. On the metaphorical level, this third slave is a hero to those who have been chewed up by this very system. He names what is true, what everybody knows, and yet what no one will dare to say out loud because there are consequences, which the slave fully receives. The judgment of the master, you wicked and lazy slave, you knew that, did you? Also sarcastically, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter. You knew it. Everybody knows it, but you dared to say it out loud, and there are consequences for that action. At least you could have invested it, whatever that would have looked like in antiquity. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who knows how to work the system. For all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance, but from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. A harsh statement, yet one that rings rather true. One that rings rather true even in this day and age. As for this worthless slave, basically throw him into hell. Hell not as some reality experienced as a future torment, but one where this guy is thrown out of the system that was giving him life into nothing. He may have named the truth, but he has no friends amongst those whom he abused because he participated in the system of extracting, and he certainly no longer has friends amongst the other retainers who double the talents. He is utterly alone in the world. vulnerable, and there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's what's happening on the ground level of this story. Jesus is not trying to equate the property owner with God, who somehow rejoices in the doubling of talents. Jesus is naming what he sees happening in his world and why there is such brokenness, marginalization, and stratification. Why there are indeed the hungry poor who cannot make ends meet, and those who live in the Jerusalem of his time in lavish robes who have not a care in the world. The Sadducees, the Herodians, the temple priests, those who are so far removed from the daily comings and goings that they can care about things like cultic sacrifices and practices. But for those on the ground level, they know this system. They know it's not getting any better. So what do we do with it? Jesus doesn't give us a way out here. That's not until the conclusion of what Jesus is preaching here in Matthew chapter 25. But I want to take this at the ground level today. What do we do with something like this? That seems so bad, negative, that comes across as bad news. One is to treat it exactly as what it is, and to do the best we can to interpret it in a modern sense. We who live in a different economic reality than Jesus, we who deal with the idea of infinite resources and that capitalism can somehow infinitely grow, that there is always more to be had, that if you just work hard enough, if you pull yourself up by the bootstraps, that anything and everything is possible in this world, except when you peel back the facade and ask the hard questions. We know that that's just not how the world works. And so this is also not meant to be a lecture against the evils of any kind of modern economic system. That is an entirely different conversation. But what can we extrapolate from a system that names clearly what we can understand going on in a world where we have a growing few hoarding a majority of the resources that leave a lot more people struggling and competing with just enough to get by, which is a global problem and can leave us paralyzed with a wonder of what to do, because we can't fix the system overnight. It is a train that has left the station, and those realities are far above my pay grade. But the question remains, and it comes down to our relationship with resources and the lengths that we are willing to go. One, to keep them, or to use them in a way that God offers, to circulate what we have been given. Because make no mistake, we go back to the statement that Jesus had a couple weeks ago, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and render unto God what is God's. Well, Caesar's money equates human beings with products. We become a commodity in this system. We become the equivalent of a dollar. And we will work ourselves to death at the expense of our own well-being to earn this. And so a question could be, are we willing to reduce ourselves or others to a commodity for the sake of playing this game? Not just humans, but creation itself, as an inexhaustible plate of resources for our soul use, for our own salvation, if you will. Or are we willing to consider the other option, that we are indeed created in the image of God and that we are solely God's creation, ourselves, each other, and all of creation, that God does not view us as a commodity at all, but that God views us like our opening of worship this morning, that we are indeed beloved, cared for, fought for by God, and that we are not commodities to be spent, but we are resources to be circulated and invested in one another and invested in the healing and wholeness of the world.
And so in a way, we have a different choice than the hero of this parable in antiquity. When we are given gifts, we can choose to use them in a competitive, extractive way. We can bury them, not participate in the system, which is still in and of itself making a choice. Or the third option, we can choose to circulate it in a different way, what some might call subversive or other might call benevolence. Either way, we have that third option, to not participate in the way things are, but to do something that maybe God intended, to use the resources that we have for the healing of the world around us. So again, how are we prepared in the immediate moment for the realities that we face on a daily basis? And it's almost ironic that historically, with no connection, this story comes to us about the same time of year when we start thinking intentionally about giving. Thanksgiving and Christmas. This almost 3-month-long cycle of celebrating, gift-giving, thinking, end of the year, consolidation, taking a look at budgets. It wasn't intentional, but it's interesting. So in this season of thinking about giving, on this very week, where we will gather around tables not only today, but throughout the week to give thanks for the gifts that we have, it would be interesting to think about how we circulate those gifts, to take an accounting of what we have been given and an accounting of how we circulate those resources in the world around us. Because with the giving thanks, as we know this time of year, also come the many asks. And I have to admit, we have a long list of them in our own bulletin. Organizations that we have chosen to partner with as people think about generosity in this season of giving, and maybe not just gifts for the family, but gifts to those in need. What do we do with our resources in the immediate vicinity of what we got so that we don't treat people or creation as a commodity, but we treat it as gift and blessing? I would argue that there are better ways to invest our resources than others. And the ones that are in our bulletin are pretty well cultivated and pretty good practices for investing. Like room in the inn, in spiritus, making sure that folks have warm clothing and food on the table, maybe not only just this week, but also in the weeks that follow. Second Harvest Food Bank. I would argue that maybe the local institutions are far better to invest our hard-earned resources into than maybe looking outside. If you want a conversation about why I will never give money to the Salvation Army, we can have that at a different time. But to think about what's right in front of us, how are we prepared to meet what's moving in our world right now? Because collectively we have so much to give thanks for, and we ought to celebrate the gifts that we have been given, the food on our table, but to recognize that that food comes from somewhere. The earth that gave it life. The hands that harvested it and made sure it got to our table. It is a very complex system that hopefully works like a well-oiled machine, but there are a lot of folks involved in that process. And maybe when we get into another stage, we can talk about the injustices that are a part of that process that gets the food to our table. But what do we do? How do we not just bury or participate in what's broken? How do we use what we have to circulate and make the world a better place right here, right now? The whole system can be paralyzing. There is a lot going on in the world. We all gather and bring with us various cares, worries, and anxieties. So what if we invest our imagining and our thinking into the belovedness that we are created with? the belovedness that gives us life, the very gift that we are, and begin with treating ourselves with the same respect that God gives to us. We treat ourselves with that same belovedness and respect and learn to see what God has blessed us with is meant to circulate as we see the belovedness in each other. That kind of living gains friction. That kind of living grows because it's authentic and life-giving. And it's the very thing that Jesus, in the entirety of his ministry, steers us toward. The authenticity of what it means to be God's creation. That's something to give thanks for. So let us celebrate. In a few minutes, let us gather around table and celebrate the gifts that we have been given, our relationships, the food on the table, and may that food nourish us, not only in our own well-being, but also in our imaginations, as we take what we have been given and make the little patch of world around us a little bit better in the very image of God. Amen.